Good afternoon, good morning to those of you not in the Eastern time zone. My name is Jeff Singer. I'm a general surgeon and a senior fellow at the Cato Institute, and I want to apologize for the delay. We've been having difficulty getting one of our speakers hooked up remotely. So that's what's been taking the time. The social distancing measures required to address the COVID-19 pandemic led to a newfound appreciation for the use of telehealth, a technological advance that has been available actually for several decades. State licensing laws for healthcare practitioners have impeded widespread use of telemedicine. Most states only permit healthcare practitioners to provide telehealth services to patients in the state in which the practitioners are licensed, which is a barrier to the free flow of healthcare services across state lines. Patients can travel to another state to receive medical treatment and even surgery from a doctor licensed in that state, but those doctors cannot provide telehealth services to the same patients unless they are licensed in the states in which the patients reside. While the pandemic led many states to suspend the barriers to the movement of healthcare practitioners and to the delivery of telemedicine across state lines, these were only temporary emergency measures. Fortunately, some states are taking steps to avoid a return to the status quo. In May of 2021, Arizona's governor signed into law House Bill 2454, which allows the state's residents to receive telehealth services from providers who hold licenses outside the state, but within any of the other states or the District of Columbia. In 2019, Florida's governor signed House Bill 23 into law, similarly liberalizing telehealth regulations. On the federal level, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services expanded permanent coverage for many telehealth services. I was hoping to have three people here to discuss this, but unfortunately, we've been unable to connect with one of our scheduled speakers. But I'm still very pleased to have with us two really expert people on this topic. One is Christina Corrieri, who's the senior policy advisor to Arizona Governor Doug Ducey and was intimately involved in the crafting and passing of the legislation, telehealth reform legislation in Arizona. And the other is Kyle Zebley, who's the Vice President for Public Policy of the American Telemedicine Association. So I'm going to ask each of our panelists to make opening remarks, and then we'll have a discussion and take questions and answers from participants. I'll be moderating the Q&A. I encourage participants to write your questions on either our event page or via Facebook, YouTube, or Twitter using the hashtag Cato Health, capital C and capital H. And please be sure to visit the Cato Institute web event page for links to additional resources related to the topic of this event. Kyle, let me start with you. Could you please give us an overview of the current state of telehealth regulations on the state and federal levels and on the prospects for meaningful telehealth reform on both of these levels?
Happy to, Jeff, and thank you so much to you and to Cato for having me today to talk about, of course, our number one topic, which is telehealth. The American Telemedicine Association has been around since 1993. We have a really wide and diverse membership of over 400 organizations that represent the width and breadth of the U.S. healthcare industry, which, of course, as we know, is very invested in the future of telehealth. COVID-19 has truly been a game changer for telehealth. There's no question about it. Oftentimes, it's called the silver lining of the pandemic. So what, of course, happened in the early days of the pandemic, as you alluded to, is there were social distancing measures that meant that we tried to make sure that federal policymakers, state policymakers tried to make sure that we didn't flood hospitals, to make sure that really only those in true emergencies and those dealing and diagnosed with COVID would go to the hospital for care. So what that meant was that they had that state policymakers and federal policymakers had to bring down the barriers that were impeding telehealth up to that point in time. That meant that we had to ensure that individuals were able to access medical care in their own homes. For Medicare, that meant that actually Section 1834M barriers of the Social Security Act had to be temporarily suspended, and Congress granted the authority to do so under the public health emergency to the administration, the Trump administration previously, Biden administration now. that allow them to waive those restrictions. That's crucial because Section 1834M for Medicare, for instance, said that you had to be in a defined rural area outside a major metropolitan area, and you had to be physically in a provider's office. You've gotten in some mode of transportation and physically gone to a provider's office in order to have reimbursable virtual care. That was passed in 1997 when you still needed a hard line and a CD-ROM in order to access the internet. Obviously, technology has gone leaps and bounds forward in the intervening 24 years, and that's an outdated provision of law that ATA had long suggested needed to be lifted, to needed to be permanently ended so that all Medicare beneficiaries would have access to telehealth where and when they need it. At the state level, there were immediately put in place licensing flexibility laws along the line of what Arizona did in that great piece of legislation you mentioned. But they did that in a permanent way. Most states in a temporary way, including Arizona before it was made permanent, allowed for a cross-state practice of medicine, particularly through virtual care. This was so crucial because prior to that, and for over 100 years in terms of the practice of medicine, as I'm sure your audience knows well, it was really purely a state domain issue in terms of who was eligible to practice care. And in essence, you needed to be licensed to provide care within the state in question. It's often a cumbersome process. It's an expensive, time-consuming process for doctors. And so having those licensing flexibility measures put in place were enormously helpful. There had been already in place medical professional licensure compacts to include the Interstate Medical Licensure Compact, Nursing Compact, the Psychiatrist Compact, PT Compact, a number of others, that if states had adopted them, made it easier for the practice of medicine and those medical professionals to one degree or another. The pandemic has accelerated the adoption of compacts, and obviously the ATA is extremely supportive of any measure that makes it easier to practice across state lines while ensuring that there is accountability in place for patients and providers alike. So humongous changes that have occurred during the pandemic. The top priority for the ATA and for our diverse membership is to make permanent as many of these flexibilities and liberalization, small hell, that we've seen in terms of actions taken by DC and state capitals. The 2021 state legislative sessions across the country have been extraordinarily beneficial for telemedicine and for telehealth. Over half the states, just over half the states, have passed, in our mind, positive laws that further enshrine telehealth as an option for patients. And so, of course, a lot of our members live and die by what happens at the state level. We've talked about licensure. This is also where state Medicaid agencies make determinations as to what is and is not covered for those individuals that are covered by Medicaid. This is the state level is where decisions are made about the practice of medicine. And we're firmly of the belief that telehealth is health, that it should be held to the same standard of care, not anything lower, certainly not anything higher. And then also in terms of the commercial coverage, private insurance, oftentimes mandates and other laws providing for commercial insurance, those are decisions made by state legislatures. So we're seeking to make sure that telehealth is covered by insurance, private and public alike, and that we're not held to a different standard, and that all modalities of telehealth, not just synchronous audiovisual telehealth, like a call like we're doing today, a meeting like we're doing today, but also remote monitoring, asynchronous care, and yes, even audio only care, should be covered and shouldn't have second guessing being done by policymakers as to what the best tool that a doctor or a medical professional can use when trying to treat their patient. So extremely exciting year at the state level. We're trying to translate that success at the federal level. So much of the flexibilities are contingent on the public health emergency, and we'll actually be setting ourselves up for what we call a telehealth cliff at the federal level if Congress doesn't follow the lead of state legislatures and attempt to make permanent change to telehealth policy and to lock in the gains that the industry has achieved and those patients depending on the industry have achieved during the pandemic. Happy to talk about any number of these issues, happy to turn it back to you, Jeff. Thanks so much.
Okay, thank you. In the original plan, that we were going to have Sal Nuzzo, who's with the James Madison Institute in Tallahassee, Florida, who knows an awful lot about Florida's telehealth reform law that was implemented in 2019. Unfortunately, he's trying real hard, but he's unable to connect into our system. So before I introduce Christina Corriere, I just want to use a little bit of his time to make a comment about the compacts. I could, as a practicing physician, I'm particularly sensitive to the interstate compact regarding medical care. My opinion is that it's important to distinguish the interstate compacts from efforts like Arizona's and Florida's to break down licensing barriers. Because now when it comes to the nursing compact, we have like 40 states basically have a true compact that a license in one state is equivalent to a license in any of the other 39 states. So that does break down licensing barriers, but there's smaller groups of states involved in compacts for the physical therapists and for clinical psychologists. There's a great deal of difficulty getting a compact underway for advanced registered nurse practitioners like nurse practitioners. And that's getting a lot of resistance from the American Medical Association, who's not too crazy about competition from nurse practitioners in the first place. But when it comes to the medical profession, the one I belong to, we have an interstate compact, but it's really nothing but an entity that facilitates license applications. So even if our state belongs to the interstate compact, that doesn't mean a licensed physician in Arizona, let's say, that license is recognized in any of the compact member states. It just means that when that doctor wants to get a license in one of the other compact member states, they have a setup in place to kind of facilitate and expedite the license application process, but you still got to get a separate license in every single state. So to me, that's really, you know, it's better than nothing, but only slightly better than nothing. It's not getting us where we want to go. Before I allow comments on that, though, I just used Sal's time, and now I'd like to introduce Christina Corriere is the senior advisor to Governor Ducey of Arizona, and knows the new Arizona law inside out. I hope you know something about the Florida law, because I really wanted to everyone to know the differences between Florida's law, which also was a good step forward, and Arizona's reform. So hopefully, Christina, you could address that as well. But let's ask you now to discuss what they've done in Arizona and anything else that's been discussed thus far.
Well, thank you, Dr. Singer, and thank you to Cato for having me. I wanted to say I had the pleasure of getting to know Dr. Singer when I worked at the Goldwater Institute prior to joining the Arizona Governor's office in early 2015. Before I jump into telemedicine, I did want to make a comment on the issue that Dr. Singer just spoke about related to the compacts. I agree that there's limited utility in the compacts because it's dependent on whether or not the other state has joined them. So Arizona and say Minnesota might have joined, so we're able to facilitate a slightly quicker licensing for doctors there. But a doctor from say New York that hadn't joined wouldn't be able to avail themselves of those same privileges, even though they might be an equally qualified doctor. So a couple years ago, Arizona took a step that we think was farther than the compacts. We call it universal recognition. It's not the same as a lot of other states where if you're licensed in one state, you can go through a reciprocity process with the board that might take several weeks. What universal recognition says is if you are licensed and in good standing in another state and you move to Arizona, we give you your license. That's the end of it. It's facilitated very quickly. It has helped us during the pandemic. As we've had doctors or nurses who relocate to Arizona, either temporarily or permanently, the medical board is able to use universal recognition to issue a license within 24 hours. So we think that universal recognition is a big step up on the compacts. And we were actually able to build on universal recognition as we worked through this telehealth bill. So I agree with the previous speaker that there were some silver linings during the pandemic. Two of them are the advancement in vaccine technology and the ability to use the EUA process to expedite that. And the second is telehealth. So over the course of the pandemic, there was an initial spike in telehealth services. We got to the point where over a third of all healthcare was occurring via telehealth. Since the pandemic has ebbed a little bit since the early days, the utilization has dropped off, but largely stabilized between about 13 and 17%, depending on the specialty, with a few specialties still experiencing much higher rates. For instance, psychiatry and other behavioral health areas. As of April 2021, 84% of physicians nationwide are offering virtual visits, and 58% of them said they view telehealth more favorably than they did prior to the pandemic. I think there's a misconception that folks who are on Medicaid may use telehealth less. I think there's suppositions that folks who are low income may have less access to technology. That's not what we're experiencing in the Arizona Medicaid program known as Access. When we looked at our data that's current through 2021, we saw that at least 31% of Access members we're utilizing at least one telehealth service per month. So they're actually outpacing the telehealth services in commercial insurance. Prior to the pandemic, only 11% of healthcare consumers had reported ever utilizing telemedicine. Now 40% of healthcare consumers are reporting that they believe they will continue to use telehealth going forward in some fashion. The reasons for that are many. It may be a convenience factor for some. It may be that others live in rural areas and need to access a specialist that does not live in their area. They may have transportation challenges or may improve access to specialty care. I think we need to ask what enabled the quick pivot to telehealth. And I think it was three things. One, it was circumstances made it necessary. Technology was at a place to support it. And there was government action at the state and federal level, including executive orders, CMS rules, and Medicaid policies and waivers at the state level. Many of those are temporary and need to be made permanent, which is what Arizona did with HB 2454. 2454 was meant to address many barriers. As Dr. Singer mentioned, there were barriers across state lines, but there were also barriers within the state itself. So prior to 2454 and the executive orders before that, only a subset of our healthcare professionals were actually able to utilize telehealth. So a doctor could do it, but a speech therapist was not able to do it. We also had barriers of where the patient could be to receive the telemedicine that didn't necessarily include the patient's home. And then the piece that Dr. Singer mentioned was across state lines. So Arizona's bill is broad. It covers all licensed healthcare professionals and treats them all the same. It requires coverage for all telehealth services. It allows, if the service was covered under the plan, if delivered in person, it allows an individual to receive telehealth services anywhere they're located, including in their own home. And it allows telehealth across state lines. This is important because for a long time, if you've had the resources to be able to go outside your own state, you have had access to every doctor in the country. You could fly to see anyone you wanted if you had the money to do it and the time to take off. This expands that now and lets anybody have that option and be able to do it from their own home. So we've seen examples where folks are able to see a specialist outside the state, but we've also seen how the changes have affected folks seeing doctors within our state. One of the examples that the governor likes to give is a family that he met with. They have a daughter who has many medical challenges. She lives in Yuma because that's where they have family supports. Prior to the telehealth changes, this family had to drive with their daughter from Yuma to Phoenix Children's Hospital 3 to 4 times a week. If you're not familiar with Arizona, that's a 5-hour round trip trip under the best of circumstances. And when you have a medically fragile child and have to make many stops, it can be much longer. So you can imagine how difficult that is on a family. Once the telehealth rules were changed and the hospital adopted telehealth, this family's visits to Phoenix Children's Hospital went from 3 to 4 a week to 1 a month. And the rest of the visits are able to happen in home, which has allowed them to have a much better family life balance and not be 100% focused on those necessary trips to Phoenix. So I'm happy to talk more about our law. We think that it is the broadest in the country, but I'll be happy to take any questions that you have.
Thanks, Christina. And I'm happy to say, and I'm going to give a shout out to Dave Tassi, who for his IT excellence, he's figured out a way to connect Sal Nuzzo. So now we're going to, this is great. You couldn't have timed it better, Sal. I'm going to ask you if you could explain to us Florida's 2019 telehealth reform bill and how it differs from Arizona's, because I know Arizona's is more comprehensive. So Sal Nuzzo is the vice president for policy at the James Madison Institute in Tallahassee, Florida, and director of the Center for Economic Prosperity. Sal, please take it away.
Great, and thank you very much, and enormous kudos to the tech folks who managed to get me patched in, and how serendipitous that we're talking about telemedicine and we have a video uplink challenge. So thank you to David and the tech support folks there at Cato. So I wanted to give, and thank you for the opportunity to speak. I wanted to give the kind of story of Florida's telemedicine, but talk about it from the very beginning of how the reform, not just for telehealth, but all of kind of the healthcare agenda for Florida kind of began. And in order to do that, I need to give a quick background of how Florida's political process works. So just by way of background, we are a term-limited legislative state. So we have 160 members of our legislature, 120 members of the House, 40 members of the state Senate. They are allowed to serve 8-year terms, two 4-year terms for the Senate and 4 2-year terms for the state House. Because of those term limits, Florida has this unique function where the Speaker of the House, who serves a 2-year term, is selected by his or her class years in advance. So we kind of know in Florida who the Speaker of the House and who the Senate President will be well in advance of that person taking the helm in the rostrum. So over the course of the last 20 years, Florida's kind of exhibited a huge strain on healthcare supply. We're a growth state. So we the growth figures up until the last data set that came out show Florida grows by about 800 individuals a day, most of that through in-migration. They're coming from other states, they're moving to Florida, they're settling in. In addition, we have one of the largest cohorts of elderly population in the United States. Arizona and Nevada are the other two states that traditionally kind of have similar demographics to Florida. And so a lot of that puts a tremendous strain on healthcare supply. We have, up until a couple of years ago when I was pulling data on the kind of the per capita figures on doctors and specialists, we were in the bottom 20% of all states in terms of the number of primary care physicians per capita, the number of hospital beds per capita, the number of specialists. And with that population growth, it's put a tremendous strain on our healthcare system in the state. So we began the process of really cultivating the conversation with policymakers over the course of about 6 or 7 years. And that kind of leads us to the House Speaker who just left as a result of term limits, and that's Speaker Jose Oliva. We knew Speaker Oliva would be coming in, and we knew of his kind of love of free market principles. And we also knew that he had a fondness for wanting to take on healthcare policy. And so our a lot of partners like Americans for Prosperity, other policy organizations worked with the speaker as he came in to really formulate a patient first healthcare agenda for the state of Florida. That really took kind of four legs. One was expanding direct healthcare, or what has been traditionally known as direct primary care. Second was repeal of Florida's certificate of need laws. Third was a scope of practice expansion for both nurses and pharmacists in the state. And then lastly, but what actually came first in the way of policy wins, was the expansion and establishment of telemedicine in the state. So Florida enacted a broad-based telemedicine reform in 2019. It is similar to what Arizona had taken on just last year, but with a little bit of nuance. So under the Florida law, any doctor can, or any healthcare provider can register with the state as a telemedicine provider. We had already had it for doctors within the state, but this established basically a universal recognition for those seeking to practice from out of state. Interestingly enough, there were two bills that passed. One was the enabling of the program. The other was the fee structure that that folks from out of state would have to pay in order to begin practicing in Florida. You do have to have a registered agent in the state, but interestingly enough, Governor DeSantis signed the expansion, but he vetoed the fee bill. So while it's a unique caveat, while a doctor wishing to practice in the state does have to pay a fee to the licensing board, if you're practicing via telemedicine from out of state, you don't. All you have to do is register with a registered agent in the state who does not have to be a healthcare provider, and you're able to do just about anything that folks are able to do within the state that's already allowed by telehealth. Out-of-state providers will also need to have an agreement for certain areas where they are prescribing controlled substances, but that's kind of minimal in scope. I would say that over the last 2 years, we have seen growth in both adoption and use, although there's certainly room for improvement. The data that I saw, the last data sets that I looked at, showed that while Florida's in the top 10 for physicians performing telemedicine, as far as patients actually using it, we're in around middle of the road. I think it's about a 17% use rate within the state as of, I think it was September of 2020. And what we're finding is that it didn't make sense at first, but it's a bit, because it seems a little bit counterintuitive, but the areas of the state that showed more growth in use of telemedicine were actually the urban centers as opposed to the rural ones. We've got some thoughts on why that may be the case, and it's kind of tied to broadband deployment and individuals' abilities to access kind of the bandwidth within some of the rural areas in the state, but it's certainly something that we're working on. One other piece of the puzzle that I know is very nuanced, but something that folks pay a lot of attention to: Florida does not have a parity provision for insurance. It is solely up to the insurance providers, or insurance covers, and the providers as to what the rates are for reimbursement on those. It's something that we thought was very important for the policy. Of course, the Florida Medical Association and some other entrenched special interest groups kind of fought to the bitter end on some of those provisions, but we were very glad that as the kind of the policy reform went through in the area or in the year that it did, that we were able to kind of get just about everything that we wanted in the sense of a purely market-driven and patient-centered approach to the policy reform. So with that, I'm happy to kind of answer some questions from you, Jeff, or from others on the path forward and kind of and go from there.
Well, one question before we take it all around that comes to mind right away is, so what are the major differences between Arizona's reform and Florida's reform? You want to answer that first, Sal, and then I'll ask Christina?
Sure. I'm not sure in terms of if the Arizona model has a payment parity. I know that Florida is a little bit different and we're a little bit more constrained in the number of different categories that telemedicine can be used for, as opposed to Arizona's, which is more of a kind of de facto anybody can practice. We did articulate, I think it was around 15 to 17 different categories for telemedicine. And certainly we want to expand on that as we move forward. But that's kind of the biggest difference that we saw as we kind of looked to the two different laws.
Christina, anything else you want to add?
Yeah, I think that there were three main differences, and Sal hit on two of them. So the first is that Arizona's telehealth bill applies to all healthcare providers across mm-hmm. the board. As he said, Florida's was a little bit more limited. Arizona also has exceptions where registration to provide telehealth across state lines is not needed at all. And so, you know, we have some areas of our state where the closest hospital that provides a specialty care may be in Nevada instead of in Phoenix. So we provided an exception for individuals who get a medical procedure in another state, that they can have all follow-up care provided via telehealth from that doctor, and there's no need to register. We also have a large number of what we call snowbirds, people who visit our warm weather in the winter, and they may have a doctor at home who knows their medical history. So it's gonna be better for them to see that primary care doctor than go to a new person in Arizona who doesn't know them. So we provided an exception for individuals who are residents of other states and the provider is their primary care provider or their behavioral health provider. They can still see that person. You know, that came to us when we were talking to one woman who lives in Arizona, and she told me that she, you know, has a weekly visit with her therapist, and she was in California and called in for her telehealth visit. The therapist asked how she was doing, and she said, well, I'm in California, I'm doing pretty well. And the therapist's response was, I'm not licensed in California, we have to hang up right now. Which didn't make a lot of sense. She missed her normal meeting. So we think people should be able to continue their care with their existing providers. We also accepted out telehealth that's provided in consultation with a healthcare provider licensed here in Arizona. So for instance, if you were visiting the Mayo Clinic and they wanted to bring in somebody from their Rochester hospital or their Florida hospital, they would be able to do that without that individual having to register here. So we have a set of exceptions that I think will be broadly used. And then as Sal spoke to, we do have parity pieces in our law. So it does require payment parity for most telehealth services. There are exceptions if the weight of the evidence shows that it would not be appropriate based on practice guidelines, peer-reviewed research, or the recommendations of the Arizona Telehealth Advisory Committee, then parity would not be necessary. But the default is typically payment parity does exist.
And Jeff, on the yeah. It's an important point on the registration part because yeah. Florida had an executive order in place during the during kind of the emergency of the pandemic to waive those registrations, but that did expire back in June. So that kind of that part of the law that differed from Arizona is now taking effect. And granted, it's one of those things where yeah, you don't have to pay, but you do have to register, which is kind of a different. Kind of animal there. But one other thing to point out was one of the biggest elements of the policy reform is it, and this kind of speaks to some of the things that a lot of the special interest groups will try to insert in order to water down some of these pieces of legislation and reforms as they come through, is the idea that you would have to go at least one time to an in-person consultation or visit before you can utilize telemedicine. And that just kind of defeats the purpose of the policy altogether. And so that's one of the things where we were pleased that that didn't end up in the final package that the governor signed, but is something that you kind of have to pay attention to if you're a state and looking to take this on.
And that doesn't exist in questions law either. We made sure to keep that.
We have a lot of questions. A lot of questions are starting to pile up, which is great. And before I go to them, I just want to remind everybody, if you have questions, you can enter them on our event page or on Facebook, YouTube, or Twitter with the hashtag hashtag Cato Health. And before I go to questions, I want to just throw out a kind of a combined question because it deals with the things that we've discussed so far. And so, Sal, before we were able to connect with you, I had commented, as did Christina, that one of the alternatives to the licensing reforms that Florida and Arizona have done that's been talked about are the state health compacts. And I have said that, you know, that's nothing, doesn't come close to this kind of reform. And when it comes to physicians, it's just basically an entity that facilitates applying for licenses in different states. But I wanted to give you a chance to comment on that. And I also, I have a problem philosophically with parity laws because, first of all, I have a problem with the state telling people what kind of contracts for payment for services, what the terms of the contracts could be, just from a philosophical standpoint. But in addition, from an actual medical practice standpoint, a lot of times what the service performing being rendered through telehealth is not the exact same, doesn't involve the entail the amount of work that it does when it's in direct contact, where, for example, you're performing a physical examination. So it may not even be fair to give parity. So I want to give Sal a chance to say something about that, but then Christina, then Kyle, because Kyle also needs to have a chance to rebut on the issue regarding compacts. So Sal, first you, then Christina, sure. then Kyle.
Sure. First off, on the issue of parity, I'm entirely with you, Jeff, on that one. That was one where as the reforms kind of were beginning to make their way through the sausage making of the Florida legislature, that was one of those things that they kept coming to. And for the most part, you know, there were relatively few people pointing out the concerns and the problems with implementing a parity for reimbursement. So at the end of the day, we were able to kind of prevail in the arguments and the debate on that. I think Florida's law is much better as a result of it, and for precisely the reasons that you reference. In many cases, a doctor or whomever, a physician assistant or a behavioral health person, is able to negotiate a better rate for doing telemedicine for a variety of reasons. And those kinds of things need to come into play as an insurance provider is negotiating with doctors or providers who are then negotiating with patients. And the idea also that the state should be in the business of dictating the prices in contracts between whether it's insurers and providers or providers and patients, it flies in the face of acknowledging that the healthcare landscape is changing so much and so quickly that, you know, a year or two down the road, those pricing regulations and that parity is going to be woefully out of date. And so those are the things relative to that. And on the subject of compacts, I think Florida's toyed with them a little bit. I like them as a second best approach. Ideally, a doctor in Georgia or in Arizona or in New Mexico or in whatever state they are should be able to locate to any other state, recognizing that doctor has the skills and abilities to perform the functions of a medical professional. There's nothing that separates Georgia from Florida other than an imaginary line decided a couple hundred years ago. And so the idea that I live in Tallahassee, 11 miles from Georgia, yet I can't go and see, or that doctor can't come down and see me, we're far more in favor of universal recognition. with the idea of multi-state compacts probably being a second best idea.
Okay, Christina, anything you want to say about the parity?
Well, I think that Sal made an excellent argument for our first in the nation universal recognition. There is no reason why a doctor from Nevada versus a doctor from Utah should have a different time period that they have to wait before they can practice in Arizona when they come here. Their skills are the same. They shouldn't be based on what that state has decided to do from a public policy standpoint. We in Arizona think they moved to Arizona, they were qualified in their other state, they were in good standing in their other state, and they should be issued a license the same day they moved here. So we're in perfect harmony and agreement on that one. In terms of parity, I think that for us, as we were crafting the telehealth bill, the thing that we were focused on was access for patients, that patients should be able to see their doctor via telehealth, whether their doctor was in-state or out-of-state. And one of the things that we looked at was some studies that were done that looked at how parity affected access. And I say that access, not the acronym for the Medicaid program, but patient access to a doctor. And what we found in there was while 84% of physicians were currently offering telehealth visits, only 54% of them reported that they would no longer offer virtual visits if they were being paid even 15% less. And that became important to us, and we wanted to ask why. And the reason was just because 20% of their visits are now online, they can't give up their medical assistant, they can't give up their medical equipment, they still have the same cost. And so our focus was making sure that telehealth was available to them, and the data was showing that the best way to do that was to provide for payment parity.
Kyle, I'd like to hear what you have to say about this.
Thanks so much. On the issue of licensure and the compacts, the American Telemedicine Association is very supportive of the various medical compacts, understanding that they're not all as easy to use as some are, in that, for instance, you had mentioned the nursing compact, truly reciprocal in nature. If you are a licensed nurse in good standing in a state that's a part of the compact, you're good to go in upwards of 40 states across the country. That's the ideal model. That would make it easier to practice, obviously, across state lines, which is clearly a goal for the telehealth community, definitely a goal for the American Telemedicine Association. But the Interstate Medical Licensure Compact, as you mentioned, and for difficult reasons, the Federation of State Medical Boards had a tough job cut out for them when they tried to construct their own compact, is not reciprocal in nature. And it, as you mentioned, is essentially pretty much a process to make it easier for you to practice medicine in other states. But you still have to register. You still have to pay multiple fees if you want to be a licensed doctor, good to go in multiple states. We would like to see it move towards a reciprocal model in future. We've told FSMB that certainly are hopeful that it could be improved. The nursing compact went back to the drawing board to make it reciprocal in nature, and we're still able in a very short period of time to get the 40 out of the 50 states to adopt. And so I think that's something that the FSMB should certainly consider with that compact. At the same time that we're supporting compacts, we do support licensing flexibility laws. And we think Arizona and Florida are just, you know, obviously model bills to that end that we're extraordinarily supportive of. Other states have also pursued their own licensing flexibility laws. We'd like to see that trend continue across the country. And so kudos to the supporters of those two bills that made that a reality in those two states. They're really setting the standard for the rest of the country. We think you can do it in a two-track system. You can be adopting compacts while also pursuing these kind of flexibility laws. We do continue to think that licensure is a state-based concern. There are differing opinions even in the ATA about that among our membership. Some folks think that there should be more of a national approach to this for Commerce Clause purposes through using carrot and stick approach to basically predicate funding, perhaps Medicaid funding on your state legislature adopting some compact to create national standards. But for 10th Amendment reasons, for the area of precedent over 100 years of states having this in their domain, for accountability purposes, and just for political reality reasons, we think you have to do the hard work of grinding it out in state capitals to adopt these various compacts and to pursue licensing flexibility laws. So that's where our membership is at the moment. In terms of payment parity, it actually surprises folks when we tell them that the ATA does not endorse payment parity. We think that states should pursue and payers should pursue what we call fair payment, recognizing that a doctor's time is a doctor's time in our mind. You know, 20 minutes of a doctor's time is 20 minutes of doctor's time, period, or any medical professional's time. But that it shouldn't be mandated, that there should be flexibility in negotiating rates, that that payment parity could undercut the ability of us to go forth and tell folks that this will drive savings in the industry. It's not just because of payment, of course, but also because of preventative care and all the things, not missing appointments, et cetera, that will drive savings in the long term, particularly if we start thinking about moving towards value-based payment. But we don't think a rigid payment parity is the solution. And so we're supportive of fair payment. Which again, recognize doctor's time, that you might not have the costs associated with a brick and mortar location, and that should be a factor. But also you have to recognize that in order to get this technology off the ground and continue to innovate, it does require levels of investment. So that's where we're supportive of. But definitely a contentious issue, one that people of goodwill might disagree with, including even in our Big Tent Association. But two extremely important issues that come up every day in my work as VP of Public Policy.
Well, Kyle, it's interesting that you mentioned the federal level reform. So I'm going to go to the first question. And this one is from Shirley Sforney, who's a professor of economics at Cal State University Northridge. She's also an adjunct scholar at the Cato Institute. And she wrote a policy analysis for us a couple of years ago called Liberating Telemedicine. And she asked this question, which is, why can't the ATA or I want to, of course, this is for all three. So I'll go to Kyle first, and then I think I'll take Sal and then Christina. In that policy analysis, a proposal was put forth that said that Congress is within its constitutionally authorized powers under the Commerce Clause to define for telehealth purposes, the locus of care as the state in which the healthcare practitioner is licensed, as opposed to the state in which the patient resides. And that would be in the interest of breaking down barriers to interstate commerce, which is telemedicine. Obviously, each individual state retains its right to license the practitioner in that state and to police the practitioner, and to set the terms of what it requires to get a license. But the locus of care is the state in which the practitioner is licensed. That actually caught the attention of some members of the US Senate last session. It was put into a bill by Senator Ted Cruz but it was only to take effect in the time of public health emergencies. Unfortunately, the bill didn't get any traction, but it did, obviously this proposal has actually attracted some interest. So I'd like, we'll start with you, Kyle, since you brought it up, and then Sal, and then Christina.
As I've often said, if someone, particularly in the telehealth community, has an opinion on licensure, it's a strong opinion. And they definitely go into two camps. Those like the ATA, where our policy council is now, thinking, like I said, you have to grind out these issues of licensure at the state level. And those that think that we should pursue more of a federal approach or, you know, utilize the Commerce Clause or, again, predicate funding on, on forcing a national standard. For instance, if you were to make a licensed medical professional, a doctor, a physician, accountable to where they are located rather than where the patient's located, you might be in a situation where, say, a California board is having to uphold Mississippi standards on abortion or marijuana, or put in your contentious state-based social issue, which I think would open up essentially a can of worms. And also, I think that there is an argument that could be made, a free market conservative argument that could be made about 10th Amendment concerns, that you would have federal encroachment on what has been traditionally for over 100 years, going back to the 19th century, a state-based concern. And so membership is divided, but our policy council has come out in favor of, constitutional, legal, and precedent and political reasons, the hard work, but the necessary work of doing what Florida and Arizona have done, and doing what dozens of states have done in terms of either pursuing licensing flexibility laws with the great model of Arizona and Florida, or adopting the compacts rather than going for more of a national federalized approach.
I couldn't add much more to that other than the fact that, you know, as a principled federalist, I'm in favor of state-based bottom-up solutions as opposed to federalized top-down ones. And so the other challenge kind of comes into play with something you said, Jeff, and that was that unfortunately, the bill didn't gain any traction. And that seems to be the case far more often than the alternative, which is you actually get a policy reform through. And so, I work on state policy. I fully believe and hold to the principles that the states created the federal government and the states created the local governments. Therefore, the states are supreme. And so that would be kind of my vantage point on trying to get a federalized solution that would work in all across all states, at least at this point.
And how about you, Christina? I saw you nodding your head.
Sorry, I was on mute. I completely agree. I'm a fan of the 10th Amendment. I believe in federalism, and areas that were traditionally under state control should be under state control. I also think you would be hitting a firestorm of controversial issues. Abortion simply being one, the time that there is abortion available without reason is very different in different states, and you would have to have them deferring to each other, which I think would be a challenge for both states that are more pro-life and states that are more pro-choice. So you'd hit it in other areas with controlled substances, where some states require a check of the prescription monitoring program and other states don't. So for ideological reasons of the 10th Amendment, I would oppose it, but I just can't see it getting through for an array of social reasons.
I'm going to, related to this, Dr. Joel Zinberg, who's with the Competitive Enterprise Institute, asks, what are the potential malpractice issues in telehealth? What is the venue of any action, physician license location, patient location, and physician location when services are rendered? Which state's laws govern the action? I think both Florida and Arizona have addressed that. So, Christina, why don't you go first about Arizona, how they handle it?
So in Arizona, it's under the registration process. They have to show just a couple things. One is that they are licensed and registered, or licensed and in good standing in their state, that they have medical malpractice insurance, and that they accept Arizona as venue for any litigation that might arise out of telehealth services provided into Arizona. So that's handled under the law that was just passed.
And Florida is exactly the same with respect to the language there.
Okay.
And if I could just add,
Kyle, yeah.
Okay.
Yes, please.
I was just going to say,
nope.
a licensed medical professional has to abide by the laws of the state in which they are licensed. And if folks are acting inappropriately, there are already levels of accountability in place. The practice of medicine is not the Wild West, even if it's being done virtually. There are clear levels of accountability in place at the federal level and at the state level to make sure that licensed professionals doing what they should be doing. And it is incumbent upon licensed medical professionals to know that they're risking their license if they are violating the laws of the state in which the patient is located, and that they're taking a great risk if they're doing so. I've talked to folks and say, what is ATA's position on ensuring that folks, you know, abide by the law? And I don't think we need to take a position other than to say that individuals need to abide by the laws or face accountability if they fail to do so.
One questioner, anonymous, asks, are mental health providers included in either the Arizona or Florida laws? And correct me if I'm wrong, but of course they are. Is that correct, both Sal and Christina? Mental health
yes,
providers
it is true for Arizona.
Yeah.
Yep.
And same in Florida. Okay. I've heard people say that because you're a doctor from or a healthcare practitioner from out of state, is still required to register with the relevant licensing board within the state and pay a registration fee, at least in the case of Arizona, that some people have said, well, that's just licensing by another name. So I would like each of you to have a chance to address that. So let's start with Kyle. Do you think that's licensing by another name?
No matter what the name is, it makes the process significantly easier for the provider and it increases the choice for patients. So obviously we need to have, whether it's licensing or registration, the state in question needs to know who's practicing medicine within their borders, and the patient needs to know there will be accountability if there is a violation of state laws or the violation of a licensed medical professional of the standard of care of which they need to abide. So if it's a question of semantics, I think it's missing the point. What it's important is that it's making it easier for the practice across state lines. And so at the very least, it is still a distinction in making it easier. And that's why these laws were improvement on the status quo.
Sal, you want to say something to that?
Sure. The only unique caveat to Florida's policy is that the registration fee applies for a licensed practicing healthcare provider who exists within the state of Florida. But because of the fact that the governor vetoed the fee bill on the telemedicine deal, if you're practicing from out of state in Florida through telemedicine, you have to register, but you don't have to pay that fee. So it kind of opened up a bit of a more of a philosophical debate on, you know, what should the licensing versus registration scheme look like statewide? Because if you're a doctor within the state and you're practicing telemedicine, you have to pay, versus if you're out of state, you don't. And it's kind of they would argue, a bit unfair. So I would suggest that I'm not sure that we want to eliminate registration altogether. I like having a registration process for exactly the points that were just made. But by the same token, I'm not in favor of the government just reaping, you know, revenues off of registration fees. And we can probably move in the direction of eliminating those fees altogether for those in-state as opposed to just for out-of-state practicing.
I'll vote for that, limiting fees in state. Christina, your comments?
I agree with Kyle's comments. I think the laws are dependent on the individual from out of state being a licensed and a good standing health professional in another state. You need to check to make sure that that's accurate. You don't want charlatans or fly-by-night folks who, if something does go wrong, there's no recourse for the patient. So the thought with registration was to make it as simple as possible. We modeled it on our universal licensing. We get these processed in 24 hours for most of our boards. I would speak to the fee in that there was some thought in our legislature to prescribe what that fee may be, to set it at something like $25, so it was actually applicable to the work that the board has to do. We didn't feel that doctors in the state should bear the cost of verifying these applications from out of state, but Arizona has a peculiarity to our law. It was called Proposition 108, which allows boards to set fees with just majority votes from the legislature authorizing the fees. But if the legislature were to prescribe what that new fee would be, you would have to have a two-thirds vote in the legislature. And when this was originally moving through the House, a lot of the Democrats were not on board because of their concerns on the out-of-state competition. And so we had made the strategic decision to leave out that specific dollar amount. That said, our boards are on a rulemaking moratorium. So in order to get a rule approved that they can move forward with, they have to get approval from the governor's office. And the governor's office is not going to give approval if there are fees that are exorbitant. I would say, though, we do support lowering fees across the board and have made proposals in the past requiring across the board reduction of fees for all of our licensing board, healthcare and otherwise.
I'm going to address this question to Kyle. I myself have testified before different state legislative bodies in support of telehealth reform. And I've noticed that sometimes I felt very lonely as a physician advocating reforms along the lines of Arizona and finding that there's almost a wall of resistance from the state medical association, the state dental association, et cetera, all the way down the line. So I'd like to ask you, as you know, you're looking at it from the national level, what kind of resistance are you seeing among the various states? And then I want to ask both Sal and Christina, how did you overcome this kind of resistance in your states? In fact, I was surprised to learn in Arizona that virtually every professional association endorsed the telehealth reform bill, including the Arizona Medical Association, which was not what I was seeing when I was testifying in other state legislatures. So I'd like to go with you first, Kyle.
Of things. One, I think that there's every reason to be extremely optimistic as to where telehealth stands now in terms of the public perception of telehealth from providers and patients alike. It's really just become a household term, universally well regarded. Polls are out of this world in terms of the level of satisfaction that folks have, both on the provider side and on the patient side, with telehealth. It's an area that's bipartisan in nature, a healthcare issue that's bipartisan in nature. We had an extraordinarily supportive president in President Donald Trump, who really did everything that he could within reason and within the law to expand access to telehealth care during his administration. That continued on the other side of Inauguration Day. We knew going into Inauguration Day, we knew going into the election that we were going to have a supportive administration with now President Biden. His team was saying all the right things, and we're talking to the community during the election and into the transition. So very unique for a healthcare issue to be this bipartisan. It's because it links rural America and urban America. It affects every American where and when they are, when they need access to virtual care. Folks know that the old rules, the old laws, the old regulations were holding back telehealth, and we've really singled out those barriers. And in states like Florida and in Arizona, we've successfully been able to overcome the hurdle. At the national level, we are very tied to the positions of the American Medical Association, broadly speaking, to the American Hospital Association, Federation of American Hospitals, both APAs, the American Psychiatric Association, American Psychological Association, the list goes on. Folks that want to make sure that telehealth continues to be an option, including the professionals that they're representing. So where's the downside? Even our opponents will have to start off saying that they are supportive of telehealth and that they think that things have changed because COVID-19. It's of course what happens after the but that you have to pay attention to. And so oftentimes we're seeing opponents grab on to a few concerns that I can talk about. But frankly speaking, even if we can assume that they're the best of intentions, and by the way, the opponents vary by states, to your point, Jeff, it's folks that want to go back to the way that things were in the U.S. healthcare system in, you know, February, March of 2020 and before. Folks that look at patients as market share and that do not want to have that market share disrupted, particularly from non-local or out-of-state actors. We think that's an inappropriate way to look at it. We think that patients deserve to have access. We think that there's a tremendous healthcare worker shortage in this country, and that the only way that you're gonna increase access to care, ensure folks across the country, across the spectrum have access to care, is to use the efficiencies of modern technology to do so. Frankly speaking, it's those folks that that seek to go back to the market share that they had before the pandemic. That's unacceptable. And despite any of the arguments that they might have, I think it usually tends to come down to that. And so luckily we have patients, we have providers that are acting in good faith, we have public opinion, we have policymakers on our side that allow us to overcome those that are viewing it as a market share issue.
Sal, you want to talk about how did you overcome resistance in Florida?
Sure, and I'll preface this by saying what we encountered in 2019 compared to the landscape right now is far, far different. I think the pandemic put telemedicine in such a position for exponential growth that a lot of the barriers and obstacles that we were encountering in the lead up to getting the law passed just aren't there anymore. But two things I'll point to that were very helpful for us. And you kind of alluded to one of them a little bit ago, Jeff, and that is the fact that a physician or someone in the healthcare arena oftentimes finds themselves out on their own when they're advocating for more free market reforms. We had the benefit of a legislator who was the chair in the House of the healthcare policy committees that were shepherding this and other bills. He was an emergency room doctor, and he was able to lend his credibility and weight as a healthcare provider to that debate in ways that, you know, quite frankly, policy nerds like me weren't able to. And secondly, was we had a House speaker that had identified this as his agenda priority for his 2 years as Speaker of the House in Florida. That in and of itself kind of brought about a level of political weight to it that had not been brought in prior years or in prior cycles. So those two things together made our jobs as policy think tank people far, far easier when we would go to testify, when we would help legislators with rebutting some of the claims. Yeah, it helps that you've got a doctor as your legislator and sponsor and healthcare policy chair.
Yeah, Christina, how did you manage to get every single state health association on board with this?
Well, I think I'd build on what Sal said. As he had the speaker as an advocate, we had the governor as an advocate. And so the governor was clear from his state of the state that this was going to be a goal of his for last year. And when you have a governor saying that, it brings people to the table. And we were able to have a frank, open, and honest conversation. There were some issues that were brought up by the associations that we were able to make adjustments for. So one of the things that ARMA had pointed out was, ARMA being our state medical association, was that they wanted it clear that a board could remove somebody's registration to provide telehealth if they did something that would result in an individual losing their license in the state of Arizona. So they were being treated the same. And they wanted to make sure that doctors in Arizona didn't have to absorb the cost of these registrations. So where they did make legitimate points about health and safety or legitimate financial fairness points, we were able to address those. But then when you just kept hearing, well, it's health and safety, I would ask, explain that. Explain that to me specifically. What is the health and safety issue? And I think one of the things that helped was a conversation in one of the stakeholder meetings where I did that one thing that they teach you not to do in law school, which is to ask a question you don't know the answer to. And I asked one of the doctors, have you ever practiced in another state? And I didn't know the answer. And he said, yes, I did. I practiced in Colorado and California. And I said, were your colleagues in California or Colorado eminently less qualified than your colleagues in Arizona? And he said, no, he had good colleagues everywhere he worked. And I said, was the boards to get into harder in Arizona than in California or Colorado? And he said, no, California was the hardest. I said, well, you're telling me it's health and safety, but you just said your colleagues were just as qualified and the boards were just as difficult, if not more difficult, to get into. So explain exactly what it is that has a health and safety concern for you. And he sat there for a minute and he said, I'm trying to think of the word. And I said, I think the word that you're looking for is competition. And he said, I don't think you'll like that word. And I said, I don't like that word, but if that's what the word is, then be frank about it and stop saying that the words are health and safety. And that kind of broke open the conversation and we were able to move along and ultimately bring them to support.
I just give this one in the interest of time, because we're running out of time soon. Dr. Zinberg had a follow-up question on the malpractice issue. I'm just going to address this to Christina, because he says, so what is the malpractice choice of laws for the example mentioned earlier? For example, an out-of-state practitioner registers with Arizona, but provides services to an Arizona resident who's now on vacation in California. The registration is an approval to provide teleservices to residents of the state giving the registration. So I assume he means now the person goes to California to see the doctor there. How would, I guess, you tell me, but I would think anything happens in California is California malpractice laws. Anything that happens in Arizona is Arizona malpractice
Correct.
Laws. Am I right?
Correct. Yep.
Yeah. Okay. Kyle, you wanted to say something about in-person requirements.
Yeah, well, I just it had come up earlier, and it's an issue of paramount concern to the American Telemedicine Association, to our members. Frankly speaking, we are strongly opposed to mandating in-person requirements. We think it ends up becoming an access to care issue. It's an unnecessary, clinically inappropriate barrier to care. It's really relevant at the federal level because at the end of last year, and by the way, the longest bill ever passed in the history of the United States Congress, 6,500 pages long. It was a little bit of an extender's bill. It was an appropriations bill, and it was the last telehealth relief bill of the Trump administration. Tucked in there, which was a total surprise to everybody that works on these issues in Congress, there was a provision that made permanent telemental health beyond the public health emergency. And that's a really good thing in that, you know, Medicare beneficiaries are going to have access post public health emergency. Obviously, we want to see Congress act for all the other services that are capable of being done via virtual care. But that was a nice thing to see. And it was a surprise. But it included a really terrible provision that's going to set an awful precedent that immediately became a top priority for us to repeal. And that's an in-person requirement. In essence, if you're a Medicare beneficiary and you're going to be allowed to be reimbursed for a telemental health service moving forward after the end of the public health emergency, you're going to have gone to that mental health provider in the 6 months prior to you having a virtual care, being able to be reimbursed for virtual care. No state practice of medicine law in the country has in-person provisions. And states have repealed them over the last decade that had them previously. States have clearly begun removing any kind of in-person requirements for purposes of reimbursement. It is a tremendous barrier to care, and we can't allow this kind of precedent to stand. And so we're urging members of Congress, there is a bill that's been introduced by Senator Cassidy of Louisiana and Congresswoman Matsui of California that would repeal that in-person provision. But it's a terrible precedent. We've successfully beaten back this series of state legislative sessions, any consideration of in-person requirements at the state level. And again, the trend is very much in the opposite direction of removing those barriers, as it's been done for every state for the practice of medicine. And so it couldn't be more important to the ATA and our members. And it's one that if your audience, the audience isn't really active about it, they should be in making sure that policymakers don't consider going down such a road.
Unless Christina or Sal disagree on the in-person requirement, I don't think they do. We're running low on time. I know Christina has at the bottom of the hour, she has to be somewhere else. So I want to remind everyone that even though we're running out of time, we could obviously talk about this a lot longer. This event is being recorded and will be uploaded to the Cato Institute website. So probably before 24 hours are up, usually. Don't hold me to that. You'll be able to view this on demand whenever you want to by going to the Cato Institute website. I'm going to use this one question. I'm going to turn it around a little bit. This came from YouTube, somebody named Honest Broker 2020. It's really the kind of the top. The question is a little bit off of the subject we're dealing with, but I think we could use it for a close. The person asks, what is the main cause of the disparity between red states and blue states in terms of life expectancy and health insurance coverage? Now, that's not what we're talking about here today. But what I want to ask you is, all three of you, how do you think making telehealth services more readily available will help to reduce health outcome disparities? That's a good way to close. So why don't I start with Kyle, and then we'll go to Sal, and then Christina.
I'll be very brief. We're delighted at the moment that by and large, red states and blue states are similarly pro telehealth. And red state and blue state governors have signed good telehealth pieces of legislation into law. And obviously, how can it reduce disparities in terms of care between various economic groups or between various states, red and blue alike? Well, it's pretty obvious. It's an avenue to allow for folks that did not have access to care previously to finally have access to care where and when they need it with the flexibility that they desire. And so telehealth is the future of healthcare because it's going to be a needed component of the goal that both parties share of increasing access to care and decreasing disparities to produce the best possible healthcare outcomes.
Sal?
Yeah, I'd like to answer this a slightly differently from the vantage point of how we view the provision of healthcare in the United States. And I would suggest that rather than saying red states and blue states, I would say liberals and progressives tend to examine healthcare provision through the lens of it being a right, an inalienable right for a person to receive. Conservatives and libertarians tend to view healthcare through an economic lens. That is, it is a series of goods and services provided by individuals that are subject to the laws of supply and demand. And so to kind of answer it, it's my hope that as we continue to trudge forward, whether it's via telemedicine or expanding the scope of the ability for nurses and pharmacists to practice autonomously or other things, that we're moving in a direction that increases the supply of healthcare that's being able to be provided to individuals. Because I got my degree in economics, and one of the few things I remembered was supply and demand. As the supply goes up, the price comes down. So the demand, especially in a state like Florida, the demand is going to continue to increase. And unless we tackle supply, we will continually be pressing up on the price points. And that, you know, inevitably will lead to this conversation about, well, the government should do X or the government should do Y. And as conservatives and libertarians like to say, the government should do nothing and let the markets begin to address the challenges. And so that's kind of how I would answer it.
Okay, and Christina, you got about 30 seconds before you have to leave.
Well, so I'll let myself be 1 minute late. I'm gonna build on what Kyle said with supply. You know, for Sunbelt states, the new growth states like Arizona and the West, or Florida and the Southeast, they were put at a disadvantage by some choices made back in the early 90s about how the country funds graduate medical education, which is very important because most folks who do their residency tend to stay in the state where they did their residency. So you have old growth states like a New York or Ohio or Illinois, where they were able to grow those residency programs before these new federal rules went into place. And all of those were built in and get to stay there, even as those states begin to depopulate or grow at a much lower level. Whereas states like Arizona and Florida didn't really kick off our high-speed growth until after. So we were set at a disadvantage in growing our graduate medical education programs. programs. So we build less of a stock of new doctors than some of those other states do, despite the fact that we're a growth state. So we have to look beyond our borders and how can we attract more doctors to move here, but also where we can't attract them, how can we use telehealth to help fill that gap? So I think part of it, you have to look at that. I would also say that in red states, you tend to see more rural areas than you do in blue states, and getting them access to that specialty care, even if it's by telehealth, is another way to get them the care that they need it in the place that they are.
Well, thank you. This was fascinating. I know we have many more questions and we can go on a lot longer, but our time is up for today. I want to thank our guest speakers for being here. And again, I want to thank our IT team, David Tassi in particular, for figuring out a way to get Sal to ably participate in our event. And please look for other Cato events in the very near future. We're always having very interesting events in multiple disciplines of public policy. Thank you very much.